A new year, a new time slot, and revisiting some golden oldies. Stay tuned. This is Stephen DeLuque, co-host with Krissa Hewitt of Ears on Art, a segment of the KCBX program Issues and Ideas, airing at 1:30 in the afternoon on the first and second Wednesday of each month. Ears on Art is produced in the studios of KCBX Public Radio, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. In today's and next week's program, Krissa and I revisit some of our favorite programs from prior years. After 13 years on the air, we have an immense library of recordings from which to choose. These interviews were those that stood out in our memories for various reasons. The first guest is someone whose voice is as recognizable as her name. Hello, my name is Stephen DeLuque. Our special guest today is Julia Child, whom Krissa and I visited just before her 90th birthday. I had initially met Julia some 20 years ago, long before embarking on my career as a pastry chef. It was especially satisfying to sit in conversation with one of the greats, a woman I have admired and who has inspired me in my professional endeavors. It was also a meaningful meeting for my co-host, Krissa Hewitt, as she now explains.
Mom and I watched Julia cook often. We watched a woman proud and confident about how she could transform good ingredients into a great meal. Confident, but not pretentious, professional, intelligent, witty, far more concerned about the outcome than about herself. To each other, we did not talk much about their similarities. Together, watching Julia affirmed my mother's talent. Based on the fervor with which Mom tackled mastering the art of French cooking, it was evident that she had found a soulmate. This program is dedicated to the memory of my mother and all the richness that she brought to her family and friends through her love, the art of cooking. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, and how are you, Krissa?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Krissa. Good morning, Julia.
We are here because we're thinking that cooking is very much not just an art form, but very much a visual art form. Thank you, Julia, for agreeing to converse with us about this subject. I was thinking we'd start kind of at the beginning of the sense of the meal, the sense of thinking about it. When you go to the store, when you go to the farmer's market, where a lot of people say that they see you these days.
You have a wonderful farmer's market here. Do you have one up here?
Oh, many. Yes. In fact, we end up having one a day in all of the different communities around San Luis Obispo.
You see the same people all.
Exactly.
As you go from vendor to vendor, what sort of things are you looking for?
Something delicious, like the last time I was at our farmer's market here, they had the most beautiful, fat, green, fresh asparagus. It was just lovely. You just couldn't resist but buying it. You know, it's odd that you don't find peas with peas in them anymore. Do you? They now call them English peas.
Right, the pea pods.
I found some of those, too, and there it's... It's exciting. I don't go in for organic, all of that so much. As long as it's fresh and beautiful, that's okay with me.
Do those things then stimulate what the menu's going to be for the day or what you might decide to cook?
Or I just buy them anyway and put them in the menu or build a menu around them.
And when you're getting to the menu itself, what sorts of things do tend to come into play as far as thinking about how a meal will look as opposed to just how it will taste?
Well, it has to look nice. At least that did teach us that the arrangement of the plate was very, very necessary. You have to have color and texture, and so it has to look interesting and appetizing, and it must look like food. It's like sometimes things are arranged so it looks like kind of a flower arrangement or something like that. It doesn't look edible.
I've always had a problem with certain restaurants who do, I call it fusion food, and they build these sculptures, you know, and I find, how does one eat that? It's, I mean, they're pretty to look at, but you're right. They've transcended the food definition. They're onto another level.
When you're putting a plate together, what are some of your things that are really important to you about how you arrange a plate of food.
I want people to know what they're eating and to be able to see it.
Are there foods that you would purposely not put together because of either how they might appear together or their textures are too similar?
I remember when I was growing up, my mother arranged dinner, and when it was all brought and we served, she began to cry because it was all white. She had forgotten to put any colors in. She just hadn't thought about the presentation. So you really have to think about that, I think.
Do you remember any real surprises of things that you weren't sure about, or maybe things that you ate?
I remember parsnips. We had some parsnips, and I pureed them. And then they got done ahead of time, so I kept them in a double boiler, so they kept cooking in the pureed form, and they were perfectly delicious just because of sitting and cooking a little more. So that was a very happy surprise.
Mm-hmm. Growing up with a woman who obviously just had a very good time in the kitchen, my mother never would have called herself an artist. So I'm glad that other people can see that it is not just about a paintbrush or a lump of clay or something like that.
Well, a beautiful meal is a poem in itself, isn't it?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are people who just don't care what they eat.
My brother is one of those. He says, food is food.
Yeah, that's too bad.
That's it. I think he's just missing out on a tremendous amount of the enjoyment in life.
That was a little bit of an interview that Stephen and I had such a good time doing with Julia Child. We continue now here on Ears on Art with another interview of a world-renowned artist.
Pietrasanta, Italy, New York City, and Medellin, Colombia. We meet someone who calls all of these places home. Co-host Krissa Hewitt had the opportunity to interview world-renowned artist Fernando Botero in Pietrasanta, Italy. She took a stroll up the hill to interview Mr. Botero in his studio.
Good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
We like to find out how people got interested in art. Do you remember when it was that it first excited you as a child or as an adult?
Well, I started making drawings of bullfighting when I was in high school. And perhaps that was the thing that brought me to my interest in drawing. One day, a little bit later, when I was like 16, I started doing watercolors, not a bullfight, but just landscape, still life, people, etc. At that moment, I became an artist. It's when you do something in order to produce some kind of beauty or art, then even if it's very bad, you become an artist that day.
Was this in Colombia?
Yeah, I was in Colombia, in Medellin, was my hometown. When I was 18, I dropped out of school to become an artist, and I have been doing this all my life, and nothing else.
I think that's called being able to have it all happen the best way.
Yes, I was very lucky to be able to do that. Of course, I came from a family with no money, but somehow in the beginning, I used to sell little watercolors. Then I won the National Prize of Painting in Colombia in 1952. At that time was $8,000, and I came with that money to Europe. Europe was very inexpensive, very, very inexpensive. Then I could stay almost 3 years with that money.
And where did you stay, and what did you do for those 3 years?
First, I spent one winter in Madrid. Then I went for a few months to Paris. And then, since I was completely obsessed by Italian art and the Renaissance, I came to Florence. And then I stayed here for almost over 2 years.
So you were excited about that work and studying the masters?
Exactly. When I came to Europe, I knew about Picasso, the Impressionist, thing like this. But I didn't have the chance to see any great art before. I didn't know the great art exist. Then, of course, it was in Madrid where I discovered the old masters. I was discovered by Charles Ebu and Piero La Francesca, that still is my favorite artist. And then when I saw these paintings of Piero La Francesca, what I wanted was just to come to Italy to see the original, to see Giotto, Piero La Francesca, Masaccio, all these paintings that I admire very much. And I'm glad I did, because I think it was very, very good, put me in a in a road to something more serious, and then I'm glad I did it.
You have been doing the painting, and eventually you moved into doing some sculpture?
Yes. When did that happen? In 1949, I became a professional artist. And it was only in 1974 when I started doing sculptures. I just stopped doing my painting for 1 year, because, of course, it's something that you have to learn from the beginning. And then I put myself completely into sculptures. But, you know, and since then I did a lot of exhibitions of monumental art, monumental pieces, many in New York, in Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, and then in all the capitals of Western Europe. I'm as interested in sculpture as I am in paintings. Then, you know, now we have like two professions.
Your whole style is one of very round, very voluptuous kinds of forms. It seems like that would translate well three-dimensionally.
Well, yes, you know, because I was very interested in volume. Can express volume in a flat surface. In my case, I was doing my figures, and I moved to sculpture, and I did my figures with the same feeling, of course, that I had in my paintings. And that's what the case in all these fantastic artists of the Renaissance that did painting and sculpture, they did the same form, the same feeling in one medium or the other. You keep trying all your life, but you know, it's not easy, it's very difficult. You have to say the same style because, you know, style comes from conviction. A conviction comes from reflection. You'll recognize my sculptures or my painting immediately.
Absolutely. Yeah. What is that conviction that you're about?
The conviction is a lot of things. And I believe that volume was a very important element in painting because it brings an exaltation of life, of sensuality, mystery. The fact that you can produce the idea of space and volume in a flat surface, you know, the most visible characteristic is that I have this interest in volume that is completely unusual today.
One of the things that I did read recently was the idea that if someone doesn't know your name, perhaps they certainly do around the world know your work because of that style.
Well, you know, most, people that see my work will remember, yes. My work has been very popular all over the world, yes.
I understand you're about to have an exhibit open in Rome.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about some of the work that will be in this show?
Then the idea of this exhibition is to present work from 1902 to today. Let's say about 18 or 20 oils and about 30 or 35 drawings based on the Abu Ghraib torture. You know, this has been a subject that has obsessed or interested me tremendously.
Is it often with your work that you find that you're responding to events and things of the time, or is this kind of unusual?
Well, two things that has impressed me lately is the violence on my country, Colombia. I did like 80 paintings and drawings that I donated to the National Museum in Colombia. Of course, I was very impressed. It's my country that I love so much. But it's not that I'm going to become the painter of disasters or catastrophes or anything. No.
Well, your work certainly has been seen all over the world.
I am a workaholic. I enjoy very much working. I do that every single day.
When you're working large in the foundry and stuff, obviously it does require other people with other skills. What challenges are there for you in terms of being able to communicate with these workers?
For them, it's just a mechanical thing. They don't have to think. I do the thinking. They just do put the clay there because they have like a pantograph. Mm-hmm. And they just put the clay. There is a tremendous physical work. It has to be done with two or three people. I am there to do the last skin, the touch here and this and that. I am always doing some corrections because, you know, once the piece become bigger, you see it in a different way. It has to be adjusted a little. Every time you change the size, then it has to be adjusted.
So it was very much the foundries and the work that was done here that brought you specifically
this
town?
I saw the founders, then I came a bit later, and I started working here since 30 years ago. I'm very fond of this town. I painted for them because in a little church That is called La Misericordia. That is a church of the 18th century, very old. I painted two frescoes.
That was a small part of my interview with Fernando Botero, conducted in 2005 in Pietrasanta, Italy. We continue our look back to previous Ears on Art programs with a visit with San Luis Obispo artist Marguerite Costigan. She is an artist creating in several disciplines and has been working here on the Central Coast for many years. The mentor, the guide. If we've been fortunate enough to have one, can we imagine what our life would be like without them? Today, I talk with local artist Marguerite Costigan. And although we spend a little time about printmaking, the emphasis of this story is really about how a life is changed by particular people. In this case, a father and a good friend. The interview took place at Marguerite's home. We were sitting in her living room, a space filled with her creations. Watercolors, monotypes, a few drawings, a backdrop that just completes the picture of the passion that is Marguerite Costigan. Good afternoon.
Hi, Krissa.
Marguerite is an artist from a long time back. When did it start in your life?
Probably when I was 4 years old. I remember wanting to draw and my mother giving me some paper to draw on that was taken from my father's home studio. He was an artist and he worked during the day in New York City as the head of Castleton Design Studio, Castleton China.
Ah.
He wasn't there when she gave me this paper and I proceeded to scribble happily all over it. And then he came home that night and saw that she had given me a piece of really good paper, and he threw a fit. And I decided right then that from then on until I was 7 or 8, I drew people with very large heads and very tiny little bodies to save paper, see?
Did he have a reaction to your interest in exploring visual creativity?
Interestingly enough, he didn't. And that was because he was busy going through his own problems at that time. He had, when I was 4 years old, a major psychological breakdown. Well, he lived in the middle of New York City, or at least worked in the middle of New York City. His family lived out on Long Island Sound, and it was nice out there. So he got to come home at night, and he always brought the city with him, and, mm-hmm. and was finally told by a psychologist, get out of the city, get away from all the overstimulus and the pressure. When I was 6 years old, we moved to this farm in Pennsylvania, and he loved it there.
Ah.
I remember him working for hours in his studio there with the windows open and whistling back at the birds and playing classical music at impossibly loud, high levels and singing along with it. He loved opera and classical music. That's what I grew up with. So that worked for him.
I have noted or seen your love of nature.
Yes, that's
where he was in part responsible for stimulating that.
Very much so, very much so. He was a kind of self-made person. He was very, very intelligent. But because of his high spirits, had to leave school at the age of 14. And my grandfather, he was a Scotch-Irishman. He apprenticed my father to a wallpaper designer at the age of 14, and between 14 and 18 years old when my father was apprenticed, he learned the old-fashioned way of grinding paints into oil and rolling them out and all of these old-fashioned things that people no longer do, stretching and priming canvases for the wallpaper artist to do his designs on. He learned everything from scratch. I remember when I was 16 and by that time had shown a great interest and some talent for the arts, he wanted to apprentice me out to a man in Pennsylvania who lived a few miles up the road back in the hills. And his name, he was a wonderful nature artist named Conrad Roland. And I almost got that position until Conrad Roland had a heart attack. We decided I ought to go to art school at that point. But the apprentice system is no longer. I did, in my mid-30s and early 40s, get a chance to have a sort of an apprentice experience in printmaking, which I am so grateful for. I can't even begin to tell you how grateful I am for master printmaker Etta Jaffa.
Yes.
She was the president for many years of the Central Coast Printmakers at the San Luis Obispo Arts Center. And she one day approached me and said, "Look, Marguerite, I hate working alone. Would you mind coming over once or twice a week just to work with me at printmaking?" And I was flattered. I was honored to do that. And we collaborated and worked together for 4 or 5 years at her house in Arroyo Grande. She has since moved up to Seattle, and I still miss her.
Oh, I do too.
She was so incredible. She was, as you probably know, a Holocaust survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And what she had to give was unbelievable. I have no words for all that she taught me. She would show me that it was okay to just try things, just experiment, and then roll things into a ball, dump them in the waste can. And I had never felt such freedom from judgment and pressure before as I felt working with this woman. I think it opened me out not only to printmaking, but to the rest of my work. And it really affected me. It is still affecting me. We have to remember here, of course, that every time you pull the print off the substrate, it's backwards.
Right. We've been talking a lot about that.
And it helps composition. It helps you really work with composition and balance of darks and lights and negative and positive spaces and the mass weights of particular colors as a way of using all the processes you go through to learn what they're doing and to learn something about your own fingers and your own tools. And you always learn something. You can't help, sometimes you can't put it in words, but you learn something when you're working toward an image, especially because you have to work backwards. An original, real fine art, hand-pulled printmaker never knows what's going to happen until that moment. And it's like heart-stopping sometimes. And that's what I love about it. That's what I absolutely love about it, is it's like heart-stopping when you lift the corner and you pull the print up and see what it is. And it's for that reason I found that I save my really personal psychological images, I save those to work in monotype because I can work with them kind of in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not staring directly at the face of the beast itself. I'm looking in the mirror. I'm kind of looking at it slantways, as Emily Dickinson might have said. There is a print idea that I finally showed last year. It was a self-portrait done when I was 45 years old, the year my father died. And while I was working on it, I was seeing too much of what was coming out, and I got so emotionally upset that I put it away and didn't work on it all this time until last year.
If we go back to your father's influence, that aspect of process.
He did involve me in process, and very, very specifically. He was a very old-fashioned European, Victorian sort of gentleman, and frankly, I have often thought that as a child, I grew up in the 19th century, and at the age,
of
18 was kicked out into the 20th century and had to learn to get along on my own and come up to speed pretty darn fast. Yeah. My father decided if he wanted me to become an artist, he'd have to teach me. He was very process-oriented. He restricted me to black and white and only pencil until I was 12 years old. And after the age of 12, I was allowed to pick up watercolors. And for 2-3 years, I could only use a very limited palette. And I'm talking 3 colors. And I was supposed to do all I could with the least amount of material. It was stringent, and it was very mechanical, and it was rigid, and it taught me a hell of a lot. It taught me to do so much with so little. It was really good for me. I was encouraged to just go out in the landscape every day. From the time I was 6 years old on that farm, every chance I had, I was out in the landscape. And so that's why I became a plein air painter.
I was going to say, that's a great segue to this whole world of yours as a plein air painter with a purpose.
Krissa and I would like to thank today's guests, Julia Child, Fernando Botero, and Marguerite Costigan. Even though some of these interviews were conducted many years ago, the ideas and insights remain fresh and vibrant.
Yes, going into these archives really is an amazing adventure for us. Next week, we'll bring you 3 more excerpts of programs past. One will feature sculptor Bruce Beasley from Oakland. His comments about the nature of what is art have rung as true to me as anything I have heard. Some of our guests have been from different countries, but most of them have been from right here in San Luis Obispo. The fun, the challenge, and the thrill of hearing creative people talk about their lives and their work just never gets old. So we hope, those of you that are new to this broadcast and those of you returning, that you'll continue to enjoy Ears on Art.
As you no doubt have heard, vast changes in programming have occurred here at KCBX starting today, January 2nd, 2013. For a comprehensive description of these changes, please visit kcbx.org. To request a paper copy of the new schedule, you may call the station at 805-549-8855 or stop by the studio at 4100 Vachel Lane, just off of South Higuera near Los Osos Valley Road.
Ears on Art is a twice-monthly segment as part of Issues and Ideas. We come to you the first and second Wednesdays of the month at 1:30. Stephen and I usually record our programs on site and do post-production here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. I am Krissa Hewitt. On behalf of Stephen DeLuque, thank you so much for listening.